And today's lecture will be all about electrodynamics. And basically, I think first 1 hour will be just review of what you should know already. And it's the most important part of my course. So I really want to make sure that you know this thing, because you will start from here in the relativity course, and you will proceed further on. So I really want to make sure that everybody knows. And every theoretical physicist should know electrodynamics, right? So it's the nicest of the field theories and so on. And then last, let's say 15 minutes or 20 minutes will be bonus. So you may look forward to learn something new. Okay, so part three. Let's call it classical electrodynamics. And to start with, I'll just write down Maxwell equations for you, which actually my supervisor told me that you shouldn't attempt to write Maxwell equations if you are over 30, but I'll attempt anyway. I have written them down, so this way I can. Students remember them, I don't. So it's curl of B minus dE over dT equals to 4 pi J. So electric intensity, magnetic intensity, or induction, and the current. Curl of E plus dB over dT equals to 0. Divergence of E equals to 4 pi. So I'm using Gaussian whatever units, so that's why these 4 pi's are there. Maybe you are used to CSI units, where you have just J and rho. And divergence of B equals to 0. Let me name them. So this is equation 1, equation 2, 3, and 4. And these are the most beautiful and very nice equations. And God pronounced these equations, and there was a light. Okay. So let me just briefly discuss what is the meaning of these equations. So first of all, how many are there? So how many equations do we have here? One? Well, if you count, I don't know, any equation for scalar function as one equation, then so there is three here, because B and E are vectors, right? So three and three is six, seven, and eight. So we have eight equations here, right? How many unknowns? What are the unknowns here? Okay, eight, six, six. Okay, so I can solve these equations if I specify what my distribution of the charge is and what my current is. So these are actually inputs, what I put there, and then I'm solving for E and B. So each of them are three unknowns. So in total, I have six unknowns. So how this is possible? I have eight equations for six unknowns. What is the problem there? Yeah? They are not independent. Very good. Okay. Some other word? No. So what I claim is that, so let me put first, that basically you have two equations which have source, J and rho. And I claim, well, and then you have two equations which have time derivatives. And it is this one and that one. I claim that the equations with time derivatives are the true equations, whereas the other two equations are something else. Okay, what's something else? So first, degrees of freedom. So we have, I said we have eight equations for six unknowns. And how is that possible? So unknowns are, of course, E and B. And how is that possible? But if you look at, let's say, the first equation, and I take a divergence of the first equation. Oh, let me maybe first take the divergence of the second equation. So you have divergence of the second equation. So what do I get? So I have divergence of curl of E plus, again, I switch these things, divergence of B and dt, and that equals to zero. Okay, but now you probably know some mathematical identity that divergence of the curl is always zero for any for anything. So if you want, it's the same thing like d square in differential forms. So if you have one derivative, it's something on differential form. If you have another derivative acting on the same thing, it's d square on something, it's always zero. So you have two derivatives, precisely those. And so this is zero. It's a mathematical identity. Divergence of curl is always zero. So then what do we have is that d over dt divergence b equals to zero. Very good. So now if you compare this to equation 4, then you see that basically equation 4 is nothing else than the initial condition for this equation, right? So if I satisfy divergence of b equals to zero at the Big Bang, then equation one, equation two guarantees that divergence of b will be zero at any time. So from here, I see that 4 is an initial condition . Okay, so now similarly, I do with the first equation, so divergence of the first equation. So divergence of curl, again, is 0. So I have minus d divergence of E dt equals to 4 pi divergence of J. Okay, I applied that. Okay, so we are almost there. So now I want to claim that this equation is basically, well, that this equation is an initial condition for, well, for that. So for this I need to switch J to rho, because here I have rho and there I have J. Right, but I can use continuity equation. Actually, continuity equation follows from Maxwell equations. If you take equations 1 and 3, I think so. So anyway, so I can trade this to dt of rho. Right, so that's the divergence equation, plus or minus. So let's see. So now what I have here is that I have, if I rearrange this equation, I have d over dt. And then I have divergence of E, and that must be minus probably here. So equals to, no, it's plus, minus, minus, that's right, equals to 4 pi d over dt of rho. And you see that it's precisely equation 3, but now there's a time derivative of that equation 3, right? So again, if I satisfy equation 3 at the Big Bang, you know, the other equation guarantees that equation 3 will be satisfied at any time later on. Okay. So by the way, this is the electric charge distribution. Some people put here magnetic charge distribution. So basically, this equation 4 is a statement that at the Big Bang, no magnetic monopoles were created. Right? And then this is, of course, a discussion still whether there are some magnetic monopoles or not. So again, so equation 3 is an initial condition for my equation. So now everything is fine. I have indeed two true evolutionary equations, 1 and 2, and then I have initial conditions 3 and 4 for these equations. Okay. So now, second, what is the interpretation? So one of them is precisely this, interpretation. So one of them is this evolutionary equation. Well, yeah. My point of view. It's precisely what I just said. I have two evolutionary equations, and then I have initial conditions. There is yet another interpretation, which you will, when you will learn relativity, you will learn that. So now there's a relativity point of view. And relativity point of view is always you have some differential operator acting on the field equals to the source of the field. So for example, and then, so you would look at the equation that the first equation has source J, the second equation has source rho, and there are no sources for B and so on. So that would be another point of view how you can actually view these things. Just from the relativity. So you will know that Einstein equation, so you have differential operator acting on the gravitational field. And you know that anything causes gravity, so there is T mu nu is the energy, so or energy momentum tensor. So anything which has energy causes gravitational field. So that's another point of view. Okay, well, there's important difference between those equations and Maxwell equations, but you will see that in the relativity course. Okay, so that's interpretation. Finally, I would like to mention other forms. So I hope that everybody is familiar with this form. But again, in September, so you will know that the same equations can, so there is, so you can combine E and B to a tensor F mu nu. So basically, it's a combination of these two fields, and it contains all the information about E and B. And then you can write these four equations as two equations. So you can write it as lambda mu F mu nu equals to 4 pi J mu. And F mu nu rho cyclic equals to zero. So these will be the first equation, two equations with the sources, and this will be divergence B, and you will see this in September. So if you haven't seen it, don't worry. You'll see that in September. There is yet another formulation in terms of the differential forms. So then you simply don't write indices. So you just write F instead of F mu nu. And then you write D star of F equals to J is the first equation. And D of F is 0 is the second equation. So it's even more beautiful. So now you have no indices. It's very compact notation. And you will learn this in January. So if you haven't seen it, don't despair. You will learn this in January. And then I think Neil will try to convince you that actually you can write down this equation as these two equations as one equation, provided that J actually vanishes. So simply you define star of F plus IF as a new quantity, and then you have one complex equation which actually describes all Maxwell equations. Okay, so that's just going a little bit beyond. So now, second part. So we have Maxwell equations. It's perfect. We have six equations for six unknowns, E and B. But sometimes it is useful to actually rewrite them. So we have six first-order equations. So now it sometimes is useful to write them as three second-order equations. And how you do that is that you introduce electromagnetic potentials. And again, you use this identity which I already said. So you have equation 4, divergence of B equals to 0, but I told you that divergence of curl of anything identically equals to 0. So basically, instead of B, I can write curl of anything I want.
So if I write B to be curl of a vector A, then equation 4 will be identically satisfied. Okay. So then 4 equation is satisfied. And then equation 2. Okay, so I have curl of E plus D curl of A over DT equals to 0. Or it's a curl of E plus dA over dt equals to 0. And then there's another beautiful identity that curl of gradient of anything is, again, identically 0. If I set this to be a gradient of anything, of any function f, phi, then this will be identically satisfied. So in other words, I write E as a, this probably, okay. It's customary to put minus sign here. So then you have E is minus gradient of phi minus dA over dt. Okay. So if I do that, so if I set E equal to minus gradient phi minus dA over dt, I automatically satisfy second equation. Okay, that's perfect. So basically, we started with 6, with E and B, and now we trade it for 4. We have a vector A and a scale of phi. Okay, but you can do a little bit better. You can actually kill one of these. And the reason for that there is something which is called gauge symmetry. So. That's right.
So you still effectively have 6 equations.
Okay, well, I have to have somewhere 6 equations hidden. So what it means is that basically because I'm trading E to gradient of phi, then I'm trading, so if this is, I have a first order equation for E, I'll have second order equation for phi. Right? So phi is one scalar quantity, but I'm doing something, you know, with the equations. But of course, it has to contain the same information in the end. So I cannot, you know, kill degrees of freedom, really. So, okay, so let us say gauge freedom. That's a very important word, gauge. And what I'm saying is that you can always rescale phi, or not rescale, but change phi to phi plus time derivative of an arbitrary function lambda. And you can always change A to A plus gradient of this of the same function lambda. And E and B will not change. Okay? So let us look at B. So B is curl of A. So this is my original B. And then I have curl of gradient of anything. Again, the same mathematical identity is 0. So this will not change B. And then if E changes, so I have gradient of phi, but I change this to that. So I have dt over gradient of lambda. Which modifies this term, but then I have dA, so it's d over dt gradient of lambda, and they cancel precisely. Okay, so do not change. Maybe there's a minus sign. Very good. So I have minus sign here. So yeah, one of them must be minus. Doesn't matter which one. Do not. Thank you. Change E and B, right? That's great. so I have some kind of freedom. Basically, that freedom is encoded in a scale function lambda. So I have one degree of freedom, which is basically arbitrary. And what it means is that I can impose at least one equation which binds phi and a. So can impose gauge condition. Well, one gauge condition. Well, at output one. Wage condition. And what is, for example, very useful for us is that we'll impose that dt of phi plus divergence of A equals to zero. And this is called Lorentz gauge condition. And I don't know which one. It's with T or without T? There are two guys. One is T and one is without T. So I don't know. Maybe this one. This one is without T. Okay, you check that. Huh? This one is with T? Okay. Really? Okay. So now if you use special, if you use special relativity, you know that you can introduce a four vector, which is you just combine the scale phi and a, and then this condition simply tells you that d mu a mu equals to zero. And that's another. Oh, why? Because you have one degree of freedom, which is completely arbitrary. So I can impose one equation which will bind my phi and a, right? And this is what I'm doing. So I'm just choosing this particular thing to be true. But you can play with these gauge transformations, and you will see that you can always do this. You can always do this. Why? Well, okay. Okay.
Well, you can put it, you can put the sign whatever you want.
Yeah, either way around is fine.
It's meant to,
it's plus.
I thought.
Well, yeah, no, that's right. Because if you just like to write it in relativistic notation, you just get d mu.
Yeah. I guess that's right. The d mu has dt with.
So if you write d mu to be dt and dr, whatever, x, then this is true, right? Yeah. I can just define it whatever I want at this point. It depends what I define, right? So, okay. So this is a gauge condition which we have. And then it will allow us actually us to rewrite these Maxwell equations to second order equations for phi and a, and they will turn out to be very nice equations. They will turn out to be wave equations. So that was part B. C is the wave equation. Okay. So we have already solved equation 4 and 2 identically by introducing a and phi. So now what remains is equation 1 and equation 3.
Sorry, choosing that gauge, I have the freedom of adding a scalar function, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So by choosing the gauge that imposes conditions on which functions can I use to have my gauge transformation, right?
No, I'm saying you can always choose lambda so that this will be true.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll fix lambda so that this will be true.
All right.
Okay, so let me start with equation 3. So I have divergence of E, but now I write E as minus gradient phi minus dA over dt. And that is 4 pi rho. Okay, so now this is our familiar Laplace operator. So it's Laplace square. And then I have d over the dt dA divergence of A. So this equals to minus Laplace on phi minus d over dt divergence of A. And for this now, I'll use that condition which I have there. So I'll trade this to be minus d over dt of phi, right? Using the gauge condition I imposed. So in the end, I have this equals to minus Laplace plus d square over dt square of phi equals to 4 pi rho. So now people introduce, so they don't want to write this operator all the time, so they introduce a box operator or the Lambert operator. And they define it with this minus sign. So it's first minus d square dt square plus. Again, it's the question of the convention, but I like this one more. So that's a definition. So you introduce a box operator, which is a second derivative with respect to t, and the Laplace operator like that. And then you simply write this equation 3 as that box on phi equals to minus 4 pi rho. And that's a wave equation. It's also a wave operator if you want. So we have wave equation for phi. Okay. So only one equation is left, equation 1. So 1. So let me put everything we have. So we have curl of B, but B is curl of A. And then we have minus d over dt. And for E, we write minus gradient phi minus dA over dt. And that must be equal to 4 pi j. So now we have to massage this expression. And there is a identity, vector identity, which holds. Basically, you have to take the first one in the bracket and then scale multiply the other two, and then the second one in the bracket and scale multiply the first two. So if you do that, then this guy writes as gradient divergence of A minus Laplace on A. So it's just a mathematical identity, nothing deep in that. Okay, so that's the first term. Then we have term plus dA over dt square plus d square A over dt square, and then plus gradient of d phi over dt. Okay, and that equals to 4 pi j. So now I'll look at this term and that term. So this term and that term is nothing else than a gradient of my gauge condition. Right? But gauge condition is equal to 0. So these two terms combined give me 0. And what I am left with, so now this is completely equivalent to, so now I have my, so only these two terms are left, right? And that's precisely box operator again. So I have that box acting on A equals to minus 4 pi j. That's a good question. At this point, I think I take it component by component. Yeah. Well, in Cartesian coordinates, it's certainly true. If you have, yeah. So we have the same wave equation. As for scale phi. All right. So again, if you write a, this four vector a mu to be phi and a, you can just combine these two equations in the relativistic notation to have box on a mu equals to minus 4 pi j mu, if you want. Okay. Where j mu I define to be rho and j. OK, so we have wave equation. That's perfect. So now we will solve the wave equation. And for that, we will use our favorite Green's functions and Fourier transform and so on. OK, so I'm sure, again, you know the solution. So the solution will be something called retarded potential. And we'll see it in a minute. So far, any questions? Now, basically, we are solving the whole Maxwell theory, right? Because we traded Maxwell equations for these equations, and then we solve these equations. So, so D, we want to solve those equations. So we can solve it component by component. So let's solve it for phi. And then for A in Cartesian coordinates, it will be the same. So let's do Green's function for that. In other words, I want to find a Green's function for the wave operator. Right, because that's our equation which we have to solve. So box on G. Now it will be function R and T. And then I put delta functions on the right hand side. So delta R and delta T. So that's a definition for my Green's functions, very similar to what we had before, but now we have more quantities there. Okay. And then to solve this, I simply write an expression for the Fourier transform of G. So for the inverse Fourier transform of G. So I'll write G in terms of the its Fourier image. Yes?
But R, big R and big T are differences.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you're assuming
that yeah, I'm assuming.
And stuff like that.
Yeah. But that's right if you have delta source, right? It'll be fine.
Assuming what?
So this big R is R minus R0. Yeah.
Basically, your Green function shouldn't depend on the relative difference, right?
Yeah. It can, in general, it can, yeah. Yeah. But I think, yeah.
All you're doing, like, even then, you can just do a coordinate transform.
So now I write this G as a Fourier transform, but the inverse one. So now I'm in four dimensions. I write it like 2 pi to the 4. And instead of R, I'll write dk. So these 3k, and instead of t, I'll write omega on the energy or the frequency or whatever. And then the free image of grt, I'll write gk and omega. And then, okay, E, maybe I'll put E here. I, now there's a small betrayal, but not really a significant one. So I'm using the inverse Fourier transform. So you had plus I, and then you had a scalar product here. So, but suddenly I'm writing minus I omega t here. And that is because we are not living in Euclidean space, but we are living in Lorentzian space. So there's actually minus for the time direction and plus for the spatial direction. So this is nothing else than what I would call still a scalar product between the vector k and omega and r and t. So if I form an x, which would be r and t, and small k would be k and omega, this is just a still scalar product. And the minus sign comes from the fact that we are in Lorentzian signature. Okay. Very good. So now I want to act with the box operator on this function. Right? This is just grt. I have done anything, nothing. So now box operator acts on r and t. Right? That's how we define it. So box operator acts on r and t. But here, nothing. It's function of r and t, so it's just function of k and omega up to here. So the only what depends on r and t is here. So I can actually pull the box through the integral, and I get it there. Right? Everybody happy? Everybody happy? So now the right-hand side. So why I lost minus sign? Okay. So now I use the integral formula for the delta function, which I derived yesterday. So you know that the delta function can be written as an integral over the exponential. So this will be 1 over 2 pi to the 4 dk d omega. E to I k times r minus I omega t. And there's a minus sign, maybe. Yeah, there's a minus sign. So this is the integral formula I showed you yesterday. Okay, so now we are almost done. So we know how to act with box operator on this, right? It's just differentiating exponential. So again, I'm just basically re-deriving one of the statements of the theorem yesterday that the derivative is just pulled down ik. So I have ik square coming from d over dr. So I have ik square from that. And then I have minus, which comes from that minus that the box operator is minus I omega square coming from there. And then the exponential is there, still there. So this is minus k square. And there's a minus, so it's plus omega square, right? And then this stands by the exponential. Okay. So this will be that, and there will be this exponential I times r minus I omega t. And the whole thing will be multiplied by whatever is left in the integral, right? So now I can compare what I have on the left-hand side and what I have on the right-hand side, right? So I look what's actually in that integral. So on the left-hand side, in the integral, I have gk omega times this thing times the exponential. On the right-hand side, I have just 1 times the exponential. The exponentials are the same, so I can solve for gk omega. So from here, I know that gk of omega equals to minus 1 from the right-hand side. And then I divide by this. So omega square minus k square. So very good. So I've solved for my Green's function.
Unfortunately, it is in the momentum space at this point. So I want to have it in the real space, so I need to do the inverse Fourier transformation. So we could cheat on this in the diffusion equation, where we simply use some properties of the Fourier transform. Here, we actually cannot cheat that and have to really calculate the inverse Fourier transform. OK, so let's do it. So we know, so going back, position space. So we have that G, R, and T equals to 1 over 2 pi to the 4 integral. And then GK omega is, OK, let me write it first, the whole thing. So it's minus minus, so it's 1 over k square minus omega square e to I k times r minus I omega t dk d omega. Right? It is this. So now it is good to introduce your coordinates so that you write, so this is a scalar product between two vectors, k and r. So I can always write it as k, as magnitude of k, magnitude of r, times cosine theta, which there's an angle between k and r. Right? So if I have two vectors and there's an angle theta in between them, I can write it like that. OK, another thing is that I can, so this is an integral, three-dimensional integral over k, but I can use, and it's actually good to use spherical coordinates in k-space. So I'll write dk as the magnitude k square dk. Then there will be d cosine theta. I can always arrange that, actually this theta will be the same theta as there by just choosing the coordinates. Think about it. But I can do that. And then there's d phi. So these are just spherical coordinates for this integral here. OK. So very good. So if I do this, and then you know that cosine theta goes from minus 1 to 1. So let me first do the integral over cosine theta. OK, so cosine theta goes from minus 1 to 1. So I have an integral 1 over 2 pi to the 4. So now this is simply magnitude of k square. So now it's become just k square, no vector. It's just the magnitude of that. So it's e to I magnitude cosine theta minus I omega t divided by magnitude k square minus omega square k square dk d cosine theta d phi. Actually, nothing depends on phi. Phi is just so I can integrate that, so it would give me 2 pi. Right, so I can write 2 pi here. And I integrate it over phi. Happy? Yeah, at this point, you're happy? OK. So I've done in one integral, a little simple, just 2 pi. Of course, it's still there. Thank you. Anything else is wrong? Okay, so one integral we did, d phi, 2 pi. Okay, so now let's do this integral. It's also simple because everything will depend on cosine theta is here. So cosine theta goes from minus 1 to 1, but it's in the exponential. So if I integrate that, all I pick down is actually this thing here will come down. Right, so this becomes, so now let me cancel those pi's. So it's 1 over 2 pi to the power of 3. OK, and then I have 1 over I k r from doing the integral over cosine theta. OK, and then an integral. So I pick up the boundary values for cosine theta, plus 1 and minus 1. Does it k still need to be integrated over 2 pi?
pull k out of the integral, right? But doesn't k still should you start?
Oh, right, right. Sorry. Very good, very good. Thank you. Very good. So if cosine theta is 1, I get e to I kr. If it's minus 1, I get e to minus I kr. So now k is there. You're right. K square minus omega square. Then I have k square dk. And I still have e to minus I omega t d omega. Hopefully now it's correct. Okay, so let us simplify our lives. So I have k square here. So let me destroy this k and the square here. So that's here. And let me do another thing. Let me just call this whole integral. So there will be another integral over omega. But this whole integral, let's call it I. And let's deal with it now. OK, so it's a complex integral. But you know how to do complex integrals from Tibra, right? So we know very well. So we almost know the result at this point, right? So anyway, so I claim. So this is an integral from, so k is the magnitude of k. So it goes from 0 to infinity, right? So k is the magnitude of k, 0 to infinity. But I claim, so I have two contributions. One is plus, one is minus. And there is k, which is odd function here. So now I can actually trace this integral to be from minus infinity to infinity of the first term. And it's the same thing. Here it will be the other part. So I claim integral equals to integral from minus infinity to infinity. Pick up the first term, I k times r over k square minus omega square k and dk. OK? It's just I'm using this. Very simple. So now what happens is that you have to draw the contour of integration. So if this is my thing, then I see that I have a pole at plus minus omega, right? There are two poles, one at plus omega, one at minus omega. So plus and minus omega, plus omega.
How do you get rid of the e to the minus I kr?
Oh, OK. So this integral is from 0 to infinity.
Yeah.
But now I'm changing my integration from minus infinity to infinity. And it precisely gives me that minus infinity to 0 gives me the other one.
The minus infinity to 0?
The minus infinity integral to 0 will be exactly the other integral.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just simplifying my life a little bit. OK, so then what I have to calculate is this integral here. But there is a pole, so I have to go around it, either down or up. So I choose up. And then this will be my integral I want to calculate, right? And then I have to close my contour of integration. And the right thing is actually to close it up. So there will be some integral I1 here, I2. So I go like that. Let me go opposite way here. We go opposite way there. And let me go like that in the contour of integration. Sorry? What was the question?
This way, I want, like, you start from here, you go this way, then this way, cool. then this.
Yeah, yeah. I'm just choosing that this will, I will go opposite way so that if this is true, you can choose whatever you want, right? You can choose. I'm just saying if I choose it going the other way around, I'll just take minus that integral, right? It's freedom. What I want to do. So now I claim this integral I, which is that line over there. So it's integral plus I1 plus I2 plus that integral over that is 0, because there are no poles inside that region. Is this? So you can look at this handout number 2, and there's this review of complex analysis. But I'm sure Tibra did that. So there are no poles inside
my integration contour. So everything, so the total integral must be zero. And then there's this Kurza lemma, which actually tells you, and precisely applies to the situation. You're integrating an exponential times something, which is nice and smooth and whatever. So if you look at your handouts, complex integration, and then on the second page, there's this lemma. Oh, it's Jordan's lemma. And the part B, then actually it tells you that the integral over that big circle at infinity actually is zero. Right? So I'm sure Tibra showed you that. So what it means is that if I choose that I go the opposite direction, I equals to I1 plus I2. And there's no contribution from that contour at infinity. Ask Tibra. Not me. Okay. Very good. And then you use the same handout. And it's the following lemma. So how to actually go around a simple pole, right? And you know that if you go around the simple pole, then you have to calculate how much angle you go. So it's this beta minus alpha thing. And in our case, it's just pi. You just have to go from here all the way up to there. And then it's residuum in that pole, right? And the residuum, so we have to calculate the residuum of this. So let me calculate, for example, the integral. So okay, so this equals to I pi residuum minus omega of function fk, of k is e to I kr k square minus omega square plus the other whole residuum at omega e to I kr k square minus omega square. Okay, and how we calculate this? Yeah? K is missing, very good. Thank you. Thank you. And how you calculate the residuum is on the first page of the thing. So if you have so it's that lemma on the first page, part two. So if you have two functions, one of them is analytic and the other one has pole, then you simply evaluate the analytic part in that pole, and then you differentiate the pole one and evaluate it at that point. So I integrate over k. So if I differentiate this, it will be 2k, right? Then I evaluate it at minus omega. And then I everywhere plug for k minus omega. Okay, so what I have is I pi e to minus I omega r. Then there is minus omega from this k. And there is 2 times k is minus omega. That's the first one. And then the second one is e to I omega r omega 2 omega. Hallelujah, so we have calculated the most difficult part of the problem. So we have calculated the integral over k. So it's I pi e to minus I omega r plus e to plus I omega r. Okay, very good. So now you see actually that the complex integration is useful for something, right? You are solving the whole Maxwell theory at this point by using a simple contour integration.
So when you're a mathematical handout, what do you mean by H?
By H?
Yeah, like.
Oh, it's a holomorphic function, which means it has derivative, yeah. Sorry. Okay, so what is our GRT? G of R and T. So it's 1 over 2 pi cube IR then there is still this integral over omega. So it's okay, let me put I pi over 2, which we calculate over there. And then we have integral over omega, d omega. And then we have first term in the bracket and second term in the bracket, and that combines with this I minus e to minus I omega t. So you have two terms. One of them is minus I omega r plus t. And the other term is plus e to I omega r minus t. And some factors, maybe not. OK, this is what we have. Everybody happy? Very good. So there is I and I. So let me destroy this I here, and let me destroy that I there. Well, 2 to the power 3 is 8, so we have 16. So it's very good. So we have 1 over, so pi. OK, so it's 1 over 16. There's pi cubed, there's pi, so pi square and r. Just to simplify the prefactors there. Okay, that was not very good. So let me do it once more. So let me put 8 pi here. And let me put 2 pi here. The same thing, right? Same thing. But now I have this 1 over 2 pi and integral d omega and blah, 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 and blah, 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 right? And what is this? If you look at that, you've seen it and you use it already today. It's a delta function of what stands here. So it's delta r plus t and delta r minus t. Very good. So it's 1 over 8 pi r. And there's delta r plus t plus delta r minus t. Very good. So that's your Green's function for the wave equation. OK, that's amazing. So first, one remark. You can actually combine these two functions together. Because you know how to, OK, I'll write it. So it's 1 over 4 pi, 4 pi, and delta r square minus t square. OK, that's the identity. So how does it work is that if you have delta of some function of x, then and this function has some zeros, there's some roots for those zeros, then so delta of some function of x is a sum over the roots of fx, so roots xi, and then you put delta x minus xi divided by f prime of xi, something like that. You have probably seen this in other course. So it's just rewriting that. So this is beautiful because what it tells us that the Green's function is actually zero everywhere except on the light cone. So c is 1 here, of course. So only if r square equals to t square, then you can actually have non-trivial contribution. So only non-zero, on the light cone. Which, in other words, your wave actually travels at the speed of light, right? So something which we knew, but it is your Green's function which we just calculated. Another remark, yes?
When we transfer the delta functions, how much do we care about the sign of the exponential? Shouldn't be minus delta r plus t plus.
Oh, that's right. But you know, delta is even. So delta r of minus t is the same as delta t minus r.
Okay.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. But delta function is even function. OK. So now what people do is that they use this form. And they, well, this is an advanced thing, advanced part. And this is a retarded part. What I mean by this is that if I send some signal, I have to wait some time in order this signal to arrive to my whatever. So if I send signal from here, it takes some time before it arrives here. Whereas this one would actually be quite opposite. It would basically travel backwards in time. Okay, so there are these two contributions. Yes?
You're setting the speed of light to be 100.
Yeah.
If not, it should be R plus ET.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so there are these two contributions. So now, in Maxwell theory, what you do is you say, well, this is not possible. You say, you know, there must be first a cause, and then something happens, right? So you actually forbid in physics, but so this is mass. Everything is correct, right? So you are solving completely correctly, mathematically, your wave equation. But now comes physics, and you say, well, this is not true. So let's forbid that. And let's consider only retarded potentials. Okay, so in Maxwell theory, what people say, and it's a physical argument that you know, first something has to happen, and then there must be a consequence, right? It's not the other way around. Okay, so in classical physics, classical electrodynamics, take only retarded. Okay, retarded part. Okay, so what does it mean? So you are solving for phi. So phi of r and t is now, as always, it's an integral of my Green function. So it's r prime t t prime. Now I have 4 pi rho r prime t prime dr prime dt prime. And I say, you take only the retarded one. But of course, so that the mass works, so if I actually destroy advanced one, I have to put twice retarded one so that it works. So instead of 1 over 8 pi r, I will actually use 1 over 4 pi r. I'm taking twice that thing here. So that's the argument people usually use. It's very strange, but it is so. So now what it means is that I have an integral over delta r minus r prime minus t minus t prime r minus r prime. That's my Green's function. Rho r prime t prime dr prime dt prime. And that's the solution. So if you want to use this delta function, you simply, instead of r prime, you put r minus t or whatever. So more generally, not for phi, but for a mu. So a mu t of r equals to d3 of r prime. Now I integrate over dt prime, and I have j mu at t minus r prime over r minus r prime. So I restore this. I put this big r, which we are using, r minus r prime or whatever. And that's the most general solution for the potential here, free space solution. And this was called retarded potential. Potential. Who has seen this? Everybody, right? Very good. So, no? One? Who hasn't? Oh, half. Okay. So now you've seen it. Okay, very good. So this is the most general thing, the most general solution of the wave.
Could you repeat, why do you take the 2 times the retarded?
Okay. Because I showed you that this is true if I have advanced and retarded part. Uh-huh. Okay, but now physically I want to argue that advanced one is not the right one. Uh-huh. But of course, if I just set it equal to 0, it will not be true. My math will not be true. So I have to, so if I put it twice to retarded one, it will still be true. Yeah, so it's a delta trick. It's just based on physics, basically. Okay. So this was the most important part of my course, to review all of this, because I think this is, you know, this is the most beautiful thing we have basically in physics, except general relativity. Okay. So now let me do a bonus for you. So any questions to this?
Sorry, yeah? Are you integrating over T as well?
Sorry? Can you?
Are you integrating over T?
Yeah, yeah. So no. So here I was integrating over dr prime and dp prime, mm-hmm. but there was this delta function sitting here, okay. and I integrated over t prime to kill this delta function. And yeah.
A question about the physics argument. I mean, the math said there should be an advanced one to it.
Exactly.
Maybe in the quantum is there a consequence?
It's very good. So basically all it dates back to how we have chosen this integration contour. You could have chosen one up, one down. That's what people usually do in quantum electrodynamics. So here I've chosen both up. So it depends on how you actually go around these poles.
So you're telling me the value of the integral will depend on how I choose my contour?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, but then you're adding.
Because basically that integral doesn't exist, right? That integral doesn't exist. You cannot go from minus infinity to infinity because you see these poles. So it only exists as a, you know, principal value integral or whatever. So, and you have to choose how you go around these poles so that it makes physics sense or whatever. Okay. So anyway, so now let's come back to 40s, 1940s. So this is 19th century mathematics, physics, whatever. So now 1940s, right? And Feynman. So Paris, Feynman story. So this is a bonus. So if you just for you to have fun. Okay. So now let me just go very slowly. So first there is something which is called radiation force. And basically what it means that if I have an electron which is moving somehow, and suddenly, so when it starts accelerating, when anything accelerated will radiate electromagnetic waves. So, well, will radiate anyways. If you accelerate this thing, it will radiate gravitational waves. If you radiate electron, it will radiate the gravitational waves plus electromagnetic wave. So anything accelerated always radiates. Okay? So, but if something, you know, so I move my electron, it radiates waves, but there's a back reaction on that electron from these waves. So once you start, you know, radiation is going out, it pushes back on that electron. And this is called radiation force. So, and this is well known. So if you have I have an electron here, and then if you accelerate it, and it will irradiate these waves. But there's a back reaction on that. So back reaction on the electron. And basically what you can say that you know all the Lorentz force. So you have forces E times V cross B. So that's the normal thing. But the statement is that once you have an acceleration, this back reaction there is another term which is called gamma. And that gamma term, well, so this gamma, it depends suddenly on a dot of the electron. And there's another term, a square times b or something like that. OK, so once you start accelerating your electron, something very bad happens. And there's this extra force on that electron due to the back reaction. Okay. So this is well known and observed and, you know, experimentally confirmed and so on. Okay. So now, what is the standard explanation of this? So standard explanation, which comes back to 1905, 1907, whatever. So standard explanation. Everybody knew that the Maxwell theory is right, and the Maxwell theory is field theory, so you have electromagnetic field A and phi and whatever. And then they say, well, this back reaction force, this extra piece, is due to the fact that actually electron is in its own electromagnetic field, and it self-reacts to this electromagnetic field. So you can actually calculate this to be like a self force. Okay, so it's self force of electron on itself. So basically, the electron is in its own electromagnetic field, and it has to do something, right?